My name is Suzanne LeGrand, and today I am speaking with Herb Childress, who is the author of The Adjunct Underclass, How America's Colleges Betray Their Teachers, Their Students, and Their Mission. Welcome. The book touches on your personal story as well as documenting the working conditions of part-time professors who are commonly called adjunct professors. Throughout the book, you refer to adjuncts as contingent laborers. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that means and why there's a crisis right now.
The term adjunct is one of many, many terms that we use for people who do not have permanent tenure-based positions in higher education. That used to be a relatively small number. Now it accounts for about 75% of the American teaching force. So we have people who we think of as adjuncts who are really teaching course by course, semester by semester, no guarantee of renewal. But there are a lot of other sort of tenuous ways to participate in higher education with the university. So you have the sort of tenuousness of the contract. How long will it last? Under what terms could I possibly be renewed? You have usually pretty awful pay. The national average for course-by-course adjunct teaching is about $3,000 for a three-credit course, which, when you really think about what it takes to teach a good course, is about minimum wage or maybe less.
Wait, how do you figure that? The published rate of pay for an adjunct is between $60 and $80 an hour.
Okay, so $60 an hour is calculated in terms of what are called contact hours, the number of hours that you actually are in a classroom with students, which for a three-credit class would be 3 hours a week. But in fact, of course, it takes an awful lot more work to do the reading, to do the creation of the course, to do the grading, to do the endless sequence of emails that we do with our students. We end up probably investing somewhere between 6 and 10 hours out of class for every hour in class. And so that $60 an hour sounds lovely, but it starts to evaporate really quickly.
So that it's not just class time.
The hour hides all of that other invisible labor that it takes to do decent teaching.
How does that affect the kind of education that students are getting?
I think that the problem is not with the quality of the instruction in the classroom. There's a fair bit of research that seems to suggest that adjunct faculty do fine in the classroom, that, you know, compared against the same course taught by a permanent faculty member, students perform about as well. They learn about as much. What's missing is the sort of larger welcome to a lifestyle that we hope that college can offer, that we hope people can be present on a campus to bring students into a new way of life, to sort of bring them into the community of critical thought and careful deliberation. And so when you have a faculty member who is contingent, who is not a permanent part of the community, it's difficult for them to know the rest of the curriculum that students are about to engage in. It's very rare that you have a second opportunity to have that same student in another course, because typically you're only teaching lower division courses. It's difficult for you as an adjunct to know what other kinds of student services are available on campus, what kinds of student organizations the student you're talking with might enjoy or appreciate or benefit from. Very often, the contract teachers are given the syllabus, given the reading list. It's not really even their course. They certainly don't get to participate in larger questions of what the curriculum as a whole is like. They're not really invested in the life of their department. So, yes, they tend to be their service providers. They're coming in to deliver a very delimited task. I think of it as schools who don't really need teachers. They need teaching, which you can buy by the unit pretty cheaply.
Students aren't really aware of this, of how part-time faculty are different than full-time faculty. To the outside person, it looks like they're all professors. What does that invisibility hide?
Well, it's interesting because one of the people that I talked to for the book talked about it in terms of passing. You know, amongst our students, we pass for faculty. In her words, our students treat us with a lot more respect than our institution does. And so we have that sort of gratification of being called professor and being treated as a scholar and being treated as a reliable guide in ways that we don't get that same sort of recognition and respect from our colleagues and from our institutions. It's very seductive, in a way, to have at least partial fulfillment of that life of teaching that we'd always hoped for. It may be a real source of disillusionment to discover that the people who are in front of them are just as sort of tenuous and scared about their membership in the fraternity as they are.
In doing your research for the book, what did you find out that you didn't know about adjuncts?
Well, I certainly, I expected all of the stories of economic trauma. I expected the stories of people trying to patch together a living, teaching two or three or four schools at a time, driving from one campus to another, not having an office, paying for their own health care and their own computing and their own retirement contributions, if there are any, and all having no support. The economic part of it did not surprise me. What surprised me was the sort of emotional trauma of people feeling as though they had done all the right things during graduate school, that they had performed at the very highest level, that they had been told all along how well they were doing and how much their work was valued, and then they were just abandoned. They were just cut loose, and there's a sense of sort of exile. If people that I talk to, they just feel as though this community that they love does not love them back.
You said in your book that the story will not be complete unless we recognize that we are refugees from a nation that would not have us. So in some ways, teachers are being told that if they do the right things, they will have some sense of job security, some career that they can settle into, and that's not actually the reality.
Right. I mean, just in raw numbers, we're putting about 55,000 new PhDs a year into an academic job market that can absorb about 10,000. And that's very rarely discussed directly in recruitment for doctoral programs or among doctoral mentors and dissertation supervisors. We all focus our mighty energies on this academic question, on this intellectual problem that we've framed, and we just drive that question as far as we possibly can. And we don't really focus on the possibility of the career, because the life of the mind is so seductive, it's so powerful. And so it's very rare that we think about, you know, what are the real odds? What is this really likely to result in? One of the things that we know is that the great majority of faculty hires come from a minority of doctoral institutions. Right? You could staff every faculty in the country just with the PhDs that are produced by Harvard and Yale and Chicago and Northwestern and Stanford and Berkeley. There's no need for an institution to go shopping at a lower ranked doctoral program. But those programs have no interest in sort of helping their potential students know that.
Is this economic?
Part of it's economic. Mm-hmm. If you have a doctoral program, then you qualify for different sorts of funding streams. Your institutional Carnegie classification changes to a doctoral research institution. It offers relatively inexpensive graduate student labor for faculty research projects, which is a benefit there.
Mm-hmm. So institutions in some ways are happy to take money for tuition, both at the undergraduate and the graduate level, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think, you know, they are, and increasingly as state government support dwindles, We've seen that in state after state. In my home state of Michigan, the state college system used to be funded at about 60% state contribution of their operating budget. Now it's less than 20%. Mm-hmm. The same numbers are true here in Vermont, where I live now. So tuition revenue has become the driver of higher education budgets. So the recruitment of students to programs at all degree levels is absolutely crucial.
And I think a lot of people are asking, why is it that tuition has increased so significantly, and at the same time, that increase in tuition is not being paid to the teachers? Where is the money going?
Well, it's going to a lot of different things. One of the things that we're seeing is that higher education historically has been a fairly scarce resource. It's been a resource that's been provided to the sons of the well-to-do. So prior to World War II, only about 5 to 10% of American high school grads went to college, and they were the most privileged, most economically comfortable, whitest, usually male students. And so the faculty was able to do a fairly good job of mentoring them because they came from similar lifestyles, similar backgrounds. Now we have an enormously diverse student body across every possible dimension of identity. We are much more diverse in terms of race and ethnicity. We're more diverse in terms of sexuality and sexual identity. We're more diverse in terms of age. We have more non-traditional or adult students, students who already have families underway. And the faculty is still pretty male and pretty white. And so what schools have done is to bolt on an enormous array of really important, really valuable support systems. Women's centers and programs for minority students and programs for gay and lesbian and trans students and programs for veterans and programs for single mothers and all of those things in student services and student life and co-curricular academic life, those are all really important. They all really help students succeed, especially from, you know, sort of first generation families who don't have that kind of cultural capital in the bank. But all of those things cost money and are in direct competition for dollars in against faculty hiring. The amount of educational technology has just exploded. There were, you know, when I went to school for the first time 40 years ago, there were no PCs on campus. There were no such thing as a PC. And now every campus is this blizzard of technological advances, both in terms of academic technology and just lifestyle technology, all the pass card swipes and the learning management system and the codes to get in and out of buildings, all of that. Now, it's estimated that intellectual technology is about a $250 billion a year industry now. So that's more people to hire and more things to buy that didn't used to exist. We've just invented an awful lot of good things to spend money on, and that has driven a tuition increase even as we are not hiring a permanent, stable faculty.
It's interesting that at the beginning of the book, you asked the question, how did we discard the idea of college faculty? So in this equation, we're spending a lot more money on educational technologies and programs, but at the same time, we're discarding the idea of faculty. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I think that there are a lot of pressures for higher ed to become an engine for workforce development. You hear that language all the time, that higher education, that colleges and states are designed to develop the next generation of the labor force in whatever that state's industries are. And so colleges are always chasing what they believe the good jobs of 10 and 15 and 20 years from now might be. And that's very much a counterforce to hiring somebody on a permanent basis. If you have to take a guess at what might be a productive program and be prepared to be wrong and be prepared, even if you're right, to have that program become obsolete in a few years, it doesn't make sense to offer somebody a sort of permanent relationship around that. One of the other things that we're seeing is a huge explosion in transfer credit. Something about 40% of students who graduate from college graduate from a school that's other than the one they started at. So transfer credit is this giant industry that really sort of makes curricula uniform. Mm-hmm. Calculus 1 at your school has to be pretty much the same as Calculus 1 at my school, because I have to be able to spend that currency in one place or another equally. And we see that with the lower division courses, with the sort of intro courses in the social sciences and the intro courses, the science for non-majors and things like that. And so those courses have a lot more people who might be qualified to teach them in any given area. The school has no vested interest in doing anything unique or anything special with them. There's actually a force to not do anything specific and unique and special with them, because it has to be transferable to another school. And so, again, there's no pressure to hire or to employ your permanent faculty on those courses. We leave those courses for the people that we can hire on a unit basis. And certainly, you know, the various credentialing agencies for the different disciplines are their own force toward homogenization. That if you're going to offer a nursing degree, it has to meet these following characteristics. It has to offer this following body of knowledge. And so you become sort of a branch of the home office.
We're in two different models of what college education should be about, it seems. So on one hand, right, your experience of, you know, being part of this intellectual community and wanting to be part of that community is one version of what it means to be a college student and be educated. And then there's also job training.
Right. And there's also the development of knowledge, the research universities that are, you know, the intention is to create new ideas, new information, new material. We have an awful lot of competing definitions of what higher ed is or could be. And the problem is that most often those definitions are unspoken. And so we don't really even know that we're working at cross purposes. It's very rare that a school will sort of stand up and plant its flag and say, this is what we believe in. This is what college is here. It tends to be a lot of looking over your shoulder at what we think the quote-unquote best practices are of other schools. So we have a lot of people who are working at cross purposes with each other on the same campus, all with good intentions, all working at the highest capacity they can bring to the table, but not really even recognizing that they're doing differing and perhaps even opposing things.
In your book, you also talk about the human cost of this way of treating a whole class of people, these teachers. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, it's at some point in the book, you liken it to an abusive relationship.
Yeah, I mean, when you a number of people that I talked to about this book told me that they had started teaching as an adjunct at some school because they believed, and to some extent were helped to believe, that it would be a foot in the door. That if you do your course well, you'll get a second course. And if you do those courses well, then we might think kindly of you when it comes time for our next full faculty hire. And so there's this sense that we're being sort of, you know, it's cult-like in a way, where we're always, you know, being praised, we're being told how well we're doing, but we always remain sort of one ineffable step away from whatever the next highest level is. But we all think it's possible. We all think, if only I do the right thing, right? If only I don't make him mad, he won't hit me. If only I say the right thing, then he'll love me. If only, and there's this sense that, you know, success is right around the corner, and all I have to do is get this right, and I will be welcomed finally at last. And so there's a real way in which, you know, we know a lot about grief, but the things we know about grief tend to come from kind of one-time events, right? You get divorced, your dog dies, and it's this rupture in your life, and you go through the grieving process, and you come out eventually on the other side somewhat healed. The cruelty of higher ed is that you go through this grief every semester. thinking the next semester through will be the one that will save me, the next task, the next set of course evaluations that show how well I did will be the ones that will put me across the threshold. And then it doesn't happen, but we go try it again, we push again, we try to get closer, and so we're on this constant cycle of hope and denial and hope and denial. And it's really a wrenching way to live. And since the book has come out, the number of people who've written to me by email or on my website or responding to my LinkedIn account who just have to have their stories heard, mm-hmm. who just feel as though they are uniquely failed somehow, and they're so grateful to recognize that other people are experiencing this and that they aren't alone and that they didn't do anything shamefully wrong.
But there's a lot of sense of shame in doing this job.
These stories of despair are just amazing, right? I mean, we're all taught that if you're talented and you work hard, you'll succeed, right? And so we're all talented, and we all worked really hard. And so when we don't succeed, it's often the case that we try to capture some sort of sense of false agency. If only I had ... then I would be okay. Right. And it's a way to capture some sense of control in what is otherwise really a sort of situation that really is out of our control. Right. When one out of every five PhDs is lined up to get a job in the academy, it's kind of out of our control. Right. It's like buying a scratcher at the liquor store.
So I'm going to ask you a question that I think might be asked of a lot of people who are in abusive relationships. Why don't you just leave? Why don't you have a PhD. You could get a job anywhere.
Yeah, why don't we just leave? It's so true. And there are a lot of reasons, and they vary across individual respondents. Part of it is just how gratifying teaching can be. This sense of enlivening a student's possibility, of seeing a student who wasn't really all that interested in some topic somehow discover themselves in it. There's nothing on earth that's like that. And so that's a really sort of emotional capture for a lot of people, the just joy of doing that. Part of it is that we don't have a lot of faith that our very unique, very specialized knowledge and way of knowing will have traction in the economic world. PhD research is really kind of unlike most other careers. It's really the only thing, the only industry that's based on not knowing, right? If you're a full-time intellectual worker, your job is to enter circumstances that you don't understand and to try to make sense of them, to try to bring your horsepower to bear on this thing that nobody's figured out yet, and to try to make some mileage on it. And that completely stands in opposition to most of the economic world, which relies on expertise, right? Which is this thing that I know how to do quickly and reliably over and over at a good billable hourly rate, right? And so this life of curiosity, this life of always being able to open questions rather than close them down and resolve them quickly for a client is really, it's an emotional life that's unlike most professions. So I think there are a lot of things that keep us in the game. And part of it is this sense that is cultivated by a lot of schools and a lot of departments that you're just around the corner from making it. The postdoc, especially, is one of the cruelest things in the world. People think, you know, well, all I have to do is after I've gotten my PhD, I'll work in this guy's lab for a couple of years, and then they'll really know how good I am. And it's just a way of sort of deferring the prize while still promising that it's just around the corner. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, we stay in. We've invested all this time. We've invested all this energy. We're really good at this. And you know, all we have to do is hang on a little longer and we'll make it.
What do you think we can do to turn around this situation? Can we turn it around?
I think that turning it around will be defined differently by different people as well. Certainly, there's a large move nationwide toward unionization of adjunct faculty, which has the huge benefit of actually trying to pay people a decent wage. That's really important, even as it doesn't address the larger question of why do we have contingency in the first place, right? It offers some degree of viability to a career path that, you know, I would wish would be less employed in the first place. Mm-hmm. I think that part of my goal for the book was to help the general readership understand that this is happening. And it's easy enough to go to the federal database, to go to what's called College Navigator, which is the federal gateway for information on colleges, and to look up any individual school and find out what their proportion of full-time and part-time faculty is. And to think, as a parent or as a potential student, is this the experience that I want to have? If we can start to put pressure on schools to recognize that we are paying attention to the composition of their faculty, that may bring some pressure on schools to think more carefully about who they deploy and how they deploy them. But I think I really liken this to kind of an ecological crisis, right? We have done an enormous number of things, all with good intentions, that have come up with this ridiculously unexpected consequence of the part-time faculty. So we're going to have really difficult and really serious conversations about what other good things might we give up in order to have our full-time faculty be a priority again. How can we make that more important than some of the other good things we already do and already hope for? As Barack Obama famously had a sign on his desk that said, "Hard things are hard." This is a hard thing. This is not something. If this were easy, we'd have done it. If there was some X that we could modify to change the equation, we could have figured that out. But we are really in the midst of a definitional question, and so we have to ask really difficult definitional questions about what we aspire to.
I've been talking today with Herb Childress, who is the author of the just-published book, The Adjunct Underclass, How America's Colleges Betrayed Their Faculty, Their Students, and Their Mission. For more information about Herb's work, visit herbchildress.com. I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is The Radio Activist on KBOO Portland.